Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View, where we talk about current events and topics of the day, and we ponder and meander around those things that interest us. And of course, we'll do that again today. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, and I'm joined with my colleague Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, as most of the time. Not always, you can't say always, but most of the time it's myself and Jim and Curtis. But today we thought we would talk about, you know, we usually pick an article and then we use the topic of that article to have a broader discussion. And we've done that again. Brad Roberts, who has written a great article in the Washington Quarterly that came out this summer. And the article is "The Next Chapter in U.S. Nuclear Policy." And of course, Brad, who wrote the 2010 NPR and has been around the nuclear world for a long time and is still sort of one of the graybeards of this profession. He's sort of taken a look at what do we need to do in the years ahead. And he takes a very balanced approach to that and makes some suggestions. He begins with a look back, you know, at the history at the end of the Cold War and what did we do to reduce, you know, proliferation risk, to reduce nuclear arsenals, you know, how we went from 24,000 down to our current, you know, 1550. And he looks at some of the mistakes and the aspirational goals. And he, you know, it's a pretty fair and balanced approach. And then he ultimately gets into what his suggestions are. And he relies heavily on the Strategic Posture Commission's recommendations. And in large part, Brad agrees with what the Strategic Posture Commission suggests. And so I thought we'd talk about this and then we would expand upon sort of, do we agree? Do we think Brad goes far enough? Where do we think the U.S. needs to go with its policy and the arsenal in the years ahead? And so with that, Curtis, let me turn it over to you first.
Well, thanks, Adam. And Jim, good to see you again as well. I really enjoyed this piece with regard to this. I've met Brad Roberts a number of times. He is a brilliant, fascinating, and I want to say very friendly individual. Really enjoy when I get a chance to meet and talk to him. So, Brad, if you are listening, due respect to you, sir. And this piece, of course, is fantastic. I think what I really want to just sort of open up with here is it's important to reiterate what you said, Adam, is that Dr. Roberts was an appointee in the Obama administration for these nuclear policy matters and these sorts of things. I can't remember the exact position he had. I first met him in that capacity. And of course, he did have a huge role in the drafting of the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review. And, you know, which was built after President Obama's Prague speech, you know, sort of a world without nuclear weapons, where we want to go to achieve that. But until then, you know, as long as weapons exist, we'll have them too, and they will be safe, secure, and reliable. The first thing that I want to just point out here within the first couple pages of Brad's great article is he notes that the U.S. desire to lead by example has helped to delay programs to replace legacy U.S. nuclear arsenal that have now passed their intended shelf life with modernized capabilities. And his, I think, to the point here that I wanted expand on is that the goal of the 2010 NPR, the follow-on New START nuclear treaty, was to sort of begin this process of leading by example and setting an example for the rest of the world to sort of also seek to disarm, if not reduce, their nuclear arsenals. And as we've seen in hindsight, the luxury of hindsight here now, right, since 2010, 14 years later, we've seen the exact opposite effect. And that despite all of the noble efforts of those who are motivated by idealism and this idea that we can transform the world into something that includes the disarmament of the nations, especially their nuclear weapons, just has not happened. And in fact, today, in the summer of 2024, we can comfortably argue, and I think Dr. Roberts does in this piece, that the world just simply is not prepared to do that. And that the effort, the 14U effort to try to set that example, not only has failed, but its ramifications have resulted in the fact that we are now behind in a modernization process that is becoming more and more delayed. And as we've studied about the non-McCurdy breaches and so forth with regard to Sentinel ICBM, is becoming more and more expensive. And these become challenges now to justifying and kind of fighting these battles day in and day out about why these modernization efforts must occur. And so I think Brad's piece here does a great job of just letting us know that that experiment was a failure. And it's time to finally come to some sort of realization of that here in the United States.
Yeah, that's a good point. Jim, what was your thought as far as you as you've been looking at the future of U.S. nuclear policy? And, you know, you're our engineer, so you're looking at it from a technical perspective and a, you know, design perspective. As you look at it and you think about where we are and where we need to go, how are, you know, what are you saying to yourself and what are you sort of recommending is sort of where we need to go in the years ahead?
Well, thanks, Adam. First of all, I don't think the audience wants to know what I say to myself because I usually say it out loud when no one's around. And then I say,
it,
huh,
Jim.
What did you do? Yeah. So
I'm a scientist, not a pontificator.
That's right. No, I do a lot of pontificating. You just don't want to know what's in there. So anyway, let me first hit an issue that Curtis brought up, and that is that we are behind in modernization, and that's not a good place to be. And what people need to think about is it takes time to spin up. There's a lag time in that decision making. If we decided today to do what we did in the Manhattan Project, and even in the Manhattan Project, it takes time. This technology, it just doesn't squat and form itself. You have to get the people, and we've lost the people. You've got to get the technology, and you got to get the capability together. So when I read through this article about the future, I see a time lag that is very important for us to consider, and we have to find a way through that. And I've talked previously on this podcast about how do we get through a lot of the logistics decisions, et cetera. And I can't remember who our guest was at the time, and they sort of chastised me and saying, well, you know, government moves at the speed government goes. And I said, who's in charge? Because the government puts its own lashes on things. Take the darn lashes off and let's move. It's for the sake of the country and a program that keeps the peace. So I know I just come out of the chute here running, but that's my, as I read through this and say, what's the future of our nuclear? We have to deal with the future by dealing with the present. And the present is we need to get things moving, even in, you know, as this article talks about, you know, bring about sort of a middle of the road kind of approach to the future of our nuclear weapons and, of course, our national strategy to be able to put away the adversaries of the present so that we can deter the adversaries of the future by having something in hand to be able to do that. I'm gonna make a quote here that I just looked up because of what Curtis said, and that is when Sun Tzu talked about this, he said, "Victorious warriors win first, then go to war, while defeated warriors go to war first, then seek to win." We need to win the battle, and hopefully the then go to war. We don't have to. We simply seek to win first, and therefore our enemy or our adversaries do not seek war. And I think that's an important aspect of this future view that's laid out in this article, is that we have to make that decision, but it's got to be moved at a fast pace. I'm going to let you guys sort of respond to that, because then I'll give you the second piece of what goes on in Petrosky's mind, and it's going to even really scare our audience. Go ahead.
Well, you know, it's Brad makes a couple of points that are really good. And let me quote him here. He says, the third major new factor in the 2024 strategic landscape is that arms control is no longer available as a tool for managing strategic competition. He then says, President Putin and Xi have placed their bets on strategic competition rather than cooperative restraint, and apparently judge that there are new strategic advantages to be gained in that direction. And then finally, he says the advent of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons and the global advocacy of the international campaign to abolish nuclear weapons have reinforced the shift of the debate in that direction, rendering much of the global expert community debate irrelevant to the management of the urgent new problems in the deterrence landscape. So the premise being that we're now in an era where arms control is off the table. We have adversaries who are saying we can compete, and nuclear weapons are a part of how we compete and win. And this is all taking place while what he calls an expert community, I'm not sure I would call many of them expert, but the people that talk about disarmament, they're focused on something that is unrealistic and irrelevant. And so therefore, many of the folks who actually in some ways care about this are talking about things that just don't matter and are not helpful to managing the competition and the potential conflict that we may have. And to me, that's an important point to make.
Adam, there's one piece here about arms control is off the table. And I really interested when I read that, said, why are we in this position at all? Now, I'm not a big arms control person, but as I've said many times in this podcast, I'm all about disarmament, and I'm waiting for Russia and China and North Korea to begin disarming so that they can set the example for the world of disarmament, and we can see that happen, and we can have a system where that's occurring. But the position we have that arms control is off the table is because we did not take the lead and be the advance and in the forward position in terms of our national security efforts against those adversaries who are outpacing us in the way that they're building their nuclear force. And by the way, notice how important the nuclear force is to them. I know Curtis is just jawing at the bit. So I just want to throw that out there. I was really taken aback by that, because it's not a position we want to be in. It's a position we put ourselves in, Curtis.
Well, let me add to that point, and that is that Brad rightly points out here that there's sort of this impression, right, that the strategy emphasizes dialogue and cooperation, sort of the strategy for arms control from an American perspective, and that the role of dialogue is to enable adversaries to discover shared interests in avoiding common nuclear dangers. I would argue that the fact that the adversaries don't even want to have these shared dialogues anymore, it is not only a rejection of the idea of disarmament and arms control by that community, the bad guys, it is a rejection of even wanting to listen to American lectures on behavior within this realm. They're tired of that. They don't agree with it. And it is a simply not nearly as reasonable as we might have thought as far as how perhaps the Soviets were listening to us. We know now, you know, after the fall of the wall, that the Soviets, you know, really did not appreciate the kinds of lectures on mutual vulnerability and other terms of deterrence that we tried to sort of push upon them. It wasn't helpful, or at least it wasn't as helpful. And then and To go on here to Brad notes here, which I think is totally on the spot here, is that they sometimes appear to interpret unilateral U.S. restraint not as a form of strategic reassurance, but as a signal of appeasement and American decline and retreat. And I think this is the most, one of the most interesting things that's in this piece, because I think it's a spot on observation by someone who has been watching this and was a part of sort of the initiation in 2010, and now 14 years later sees that it is the adversary that really sees this behavior that we are trying to do, this behavior of example of de-emphasizing our nuclear deterrent as a strategic tool, as a sign of weakness and retrenchment. And it is in fact encouraging, not discouraging, adversary behavior in the nuclear side, and so we seem to be just unable to recognize that this is in fact the sort of a ramification of this behavior. We just continue, I think, to get this wrong, and we are not judging our adversaries by their actions. We seem to keep misinterpreting their intent, and the reality here is that their intent is hostile. And their reaction is productive from their perspective. And we need to figure out how to counter that productivity. And it isn't by begging and conciliating to their demands, appeasing and accommodating. It is about changing the deterrence onus and placing it off of our shoulders and onto theirs.
You know, the challenge really here, to sort of piggyback on what you just said, this idea that we have offered to reduce the importance of nuclear weapons. And of course, what does that inherently mean? It means we're going to focus our efforts on our advanced conventional precision guided munitions, where we have a tremendous advantage over them. So if I'm a Russian or Chinese, and the Americans, you know, and I'm listening to the Americans say, hey, let's de-emphasize nukes. What I hear them saying is, hey, let's emphasize where we're strongest and where you're weakest, you the Chinese, you the Russians, and, you know, we'll have an even greater advantage over you than we already do. That's what I struggle with is, how is that concept so hard for people to comprehend? Mm-hmm. And why do people never seem to put themselves in the seat of Xi Jinping or of Vladimir Putin and look at the world through their glasses and understand that when we say things, they're not sitting there going, oh, well, those Americans, they're really idealistic and they mean well. Don't judge them on their actions. Judge them on their intentions, because as long as they mean well, it doesn't matter if everything works out terribly and especially bad for us. That's not how we should judge them. It perplexes me that we don't think this way.
Yeah, that becomes part of the, you know, understanding of how nations work together, how people work together, organizations, nations, etc., is that, you know, everyone is always looking to their advantage and someone has to be the power broker. And we want to be in that position as the power broker in all these situations. That helps to bring about the global norms, because our adversaries are showing they don't care for the global norms. And that's a major issue. But I want to go to another piece of this article, and unless Curtis is going to like be chewing on his microphone there as you watch him on YouTube here. But I want to touch another part, because this whole article is about the future of strategy and the future of our primarily our nuclear weapons posture. And in preparation for this, I decided to go back and look at people Hollywood primarily, looking at our future. So I went back and I watched the first of the Planet of the Apes series, you know, where everyone was worried that, you know, the future was going to be a nuclear bomb is going to destroy the entire world. This 1968, that was the posture. Oh no, the world's going to die. We're going to be at war. The planet's going to die because we were building all these weapons. And we had thousands of times more weapons than we do now. And then I watched the day after. Oh no, the entire world is going to be destroyed by all these things. Notice those projections never existed. They never happened. And why? Because of an incorrect view of the value of what those nuclear weapons bought us and the value that they bring to the table now. And so when we look at the future, we've got to look at a future of what is going to cause our adversaries to think twice about starting and involving themselves into a global war, what's a great power war. And we find that the nuclear weapons are a major component to stopping that war. Again, I went back and looked at all my Sun Tzu references, and many times you see the real art of fighting is not, or winning is not fighting at all, that no country can do any, you know, will benefit from huge power competitions. And that, for our future, is where we need to be focused. And what does that? Well, for now, you're not going to stop conflict. People are going to have arguments. We have arguments. I've argued with Adam. I've argued with Curtis. And they've beat me up in the same meetings. We have disagreements. That's okay.
You know
that's
what's great about our disagreements, though, Jim?
I have nukes.
I am always willing to let you be wrong and still be your friend. That's exactly. What's great about our arguments.
So I want to build on what you guys both said here, because I think this is fascinating. And the idea here is that Brad talks about in his piece here that after the victories in Gulf War 1991, and even to some degree in the Allied force in the late 90s in the Balkans and even Iraq 2003 and so forth. He notes that Xi and Putin and to some degree KJU, sort of went to school and Brad is really big on his theories of victory. And yes. I think, you know, sometimes for me, sometimes he's right, sometimes he's wrong. But these three, I think, are very good. And he pointed out three and he said what they decided they needed to do in order to, if you will, beat the West is to identify asymmetry of interest. Okay. They care more about you. Russia cares more about Ukraine than perhaps we do. China might care more about Taiwan than perhaps we do. At least that's what they hope. Right. And so if we allow asymmetry of interest to sort of develop, that becomes an area where they think they can be more victorious. So in other words, their idea is not to figure out how to invade Texas. Yep. Right. Their idea is to figure out how to invade something that we might care less about. The second one is that the small use of nuclear weapons might be necessary, and it's certainly okay, in order to achieve their desired effects or their national interests. They are
and
not,
doesn't lead to Armageddon.
Correct.
That's right. That's right.
That these are bigger bombs, but not necessarily strategic game changers. So perhaps SecDef Mattis at the time when he said any use of any size nuke has a strategic effect, only in that it might draw the United States into a war, but not really in the effect that it is going to kill, you know, massive amounts of people and those sorts of things. It might create an escalatory challenge, and you could view that as a strategic reaction. But for the most part, they don't think of it that way. They see the possible use of nuclear weapons on the battlefield or low yield as just a necessary tool to achieve their national interests. And third is that they realize that by threatening the use of those low yield weapons on the battlefield,
that is their use,
raises the stakes for Western, specifically American strategists, that increased risk might simply just keep us out of the war. And this is coming. We see this, right? And they see this as a success. And so I think Brad's identification of these three series of theories of victory are quite spot on here as how our adversaries are not only seeing how they can utilize the capabilities that they have, the strengths that they have to conquer the weaknesses that they perceive, but it is also within themselves. But it is also to figure out how they can, as you mentioned in your Sun Tzu quote, how they can defeat the West without ever having to use the weapon. And I think he captures this very well, and you did as well, Jim and Adam. So thanks.
Yeah, you know, he mentions Alexis de Tocqueville in his analysis of how democracies are slow to rise, but when they do, they can be very powerful and successful. To me, though, the challenge here is that nuclear weapons fundamentally have the ability to change that dynamic. They don't give you the time to sort of, you know, like World War II, where we, you know, we kicked off a draft and we built the forces and we turned Ford plants into tank plants. And you might not have that option. And with nuclear weapons, you really need to be prepared early on. And that's the challenge I see for us, is that, you know, we agreed upon nuclear modernization in 2010. I know we're only 15 years into that modernization, and hopefully in the next 10 years, we'll have something to show for that first 15. So, you know, maybe 20, 25 years, we'll have something that'll last us another 30 or 40, which, hey, what's wrong with that? A 50-year plan to get something new. But this idea that we're going to have the time to sort of everybody get mad, everybody say we got to do something, consolidate political will, allocate resources, build, you know, change industry to focus on this. If our adversaries have done that, which they have, we're not going to have that time. So we need to act now.
And Adam, that was my point, is that we have to be in a state of preparedness that keeps our adversaries from seeing an advantage to starting any kind of conflict that could escalate. And your comment about nuclear weapons, I'll just also say, though, the conventional weapons, the, you know, with space and cyber, etc., they speed things up as well. You know, it's not just nuclear weapons that makes us go fast. And it's why we need to be diligent and prepared and ready, not because we want to be the aggressor, but because we want to stop the aggressor. And if we stop the aggressor by seeing that there's no chance of victory, then they back out. And then negotiations, then arms control, and those things can be discussed. Okay. But who's going to discuss arms? You know, who's going to discuss arms control when victory is certain? I don't think that's a very good plan. And yeah, I think our adversaries are starting to see things that way. We're probably near the end here. I don't know if Curtis wants to say something. I'll put one other piece here that sort of fits into Curtis. And thanks for looking at this from the adversary standpoint, my Sun Tzu quote. So I don't have this other one in my head. Again, I read through. There's another quote that's very interesting, and I think we need to think about in our future. And that is, when you have the strength, you should attack. Again, I'm paraphrasing. When you have the strength, you should attack. When you are weak, walk away, or they'll attack.
Appease.
The best. That's right. But when you and your adversary are equal, then peace is available. Interesting way to look at that.
Yeah, it is. I want to jump back to the de Tocqueville quote. Man, I always screw his name up. I'm sorry. Alex, de Tocqueville, in the idea that democracy sort of roused into a remarkable vigor. I hardly think that a 35-year modernization process is of any vigor. It's certainly not remarkable. Now, I don't mean to cast a whole lot of shade on the defense industrial capacity and our good friends at you named the federal contractor that is building the modernization effort. But the point here is beyond that. It's above that. It is that the national will to do this has not been properly ignited. And the idea here is that we are constantly battling those whose motivations are from an opposite side of this argument. The disarmament community, those that are who might be America haters, panda huggers, however you want to refer to these different sorts of people who just sort of want to try to convey that this capability, the nuclear arsenal, is overly expensive, that it is destabilizing, and that it is somehow unnecessary. And the reality is that is all dangerous talk. And that to your paraphrased quote, stability, I really think, comes from symmetry in some manner. And you have to present yourself and your capabilities in a way that the adversary has sufficient fear that not acting is a better action, right? Than actually, acting and doing the attack. So we have to do that. We cannot project this idea that we are somehow weak or lack credibility. Because not only do you have this potential where we can be drawn into a war, but allies will begin to do things on their own in this whole idea of proliferation, which I think has some challenges here. The portion of this where I actually disagree with Dr. Roberts in the idea that that allies will actually seek to they'll be upset that if we're not building more, or that they might actually proliferate if we don't build more. And those portions of those things I think are very interesting, and I think they are good examples of what can happen. But if you're going to commit to a non-proliferation extended deterrence policy, then you need to have the capacity to carry through on that. Otherwise, you need to be willing to allow your allies to participate and defend themselves and deter mm-hmm. for themselves in that regard. And I think they're still in an exuberant idea that America should carry this burden on its own. And I'm kind of middle of the road on this, but we just have to understand that if we don't, they will. If we don't want them to, then we better.
And they need to know that we have that stance. That's the important piece also, correct. Projecting correct. That.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, and I need to take a minute or two to tell the listeners about some great things that we've got going on. So if you'll wait a couple of weeks, NIDS will be releasing its version of a nuclear strategy for the next administration, whoever that may be. And we're going to have a new website. So you'll be able to access the strategy, the podcasts, all of that. And then, of course, we are starting a new series on the NIDS view. And Major General retired Don Alston, who was the who's a senior leader, Air Force senior leader, a former missileer, a great guy. He's doing our first episode for the, NIDS knowledge on the part that risk, trust, and consequences play in nuclear deterrence. And we're, as you may or may not know, if you've seen who's on the team, we've got a number of retired general officers, and we're going to be asking them to give their leadership insights. And we'll be asking others who have played senior roles in the nuclear enterprise to give leadership insights. So that's coming up. And then, of course, we want to remind you, Curtis spends quite a bit of time every morning looking for great articles that he then posts out on our Twitter feed or our X feed. So go read what Curtis posts. It's always interesting. Keep you informed. And he also usually has good commentary. Jim Petrosky is just about to complete for the NIDS Academy, which is our educational arm. He's completing a really useful and sort of accessible, take on nuclear issues from an engineer's perspective, but understandable to others.
nuclear weapons in effects, Adam. I know those are big words for you.
For dummies. Yeah, they are. For dummies. So, and, you know, so we've got a lot going on. So, so make sure you check us out. Check out the website. Go to Global Security Review. We've got our articles every day, new articles, and we repost good stuff we find. So you can get your information there. We've got the leadership series. We've got X. And, of course, we're going to be releasing the strategy in a couple of weeks. So, you know, there's a lot going on. It's more than just listening to my sweet, sweet voice once a week. We've got more for you. We've got, oh, yeah, what about NIDS Down Under? We're our Australian contingent. Yep. You get an Australian perspective. Or space. Chris Stone. Yes, Chris Stone's doing real space strategy. So you can, it's a one-stop shop, really. And then I do NucleCast for ANWA Deterrence Center. That's another great podcast. That's an interview show. So there's a lot going on. There's a lot of collaboration. If you want to get informed, you can get informed. And then we're out there writing and thinking. Interact with us. Email us. Tell us what you think. Linda Lucy, you know, we've had him on the show, and we talk regularly because he's interested in Taiwan. So just stay involved. You know, we're here and we're listening and we care what you think and we're out there to try to inform. So, of course, as always, I wanted to remind you that you got to think deterrence, as always. But, of course, I also want to thank you for listening to the show drink the Kool-Aid and spread the message. And we'll look forward to seeing you on the next episode. So thanks, Jim. Thanks, Curtis.
Yep, a lot going on at deterrence.com. Thanks, Adam.
Alrighty, y'all have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.